So he's right. I have no idea about what an NBA lockout is, I must confess. I know what lockouts are. That's when my keys are in the car. That's why I have several redundant sets of keys around the, in case I forget where one set is. I know where, at least I can remember where one or two others are. And it's a delight here that we're to be with you again today. We've been spending weeks and weeks on the introduction to this course. And we actually get into the course today. We literally spent 5 or 6 Sundays, I believe, on just trying to set the framework for what we were going to talk about here when we look at the most incredible 3 to 6 hours that the universe has ever seen, the work of Christ that Friday afternoon. And so in preparation, let's open with a word of prayer about this too. Father, we do still our hearts. We are amazed that you broke into history. Right in front of us all. You didn't do this in a corner. Quite public. Quite surprising how you did this. The depths of your love, the depths of your non-arrogance, the compassion with what you, and the gentleness with which you approach us. We pray this as we look at what you've done in history and at your word and the background sacrifice in the Old Testament and history as a preparation for us to understanding the massiveness of the work of your Son, that we would have a new appreciation for the depth of your commitment and the significance and of your work. We ask this for the honor of your Son who did this for us out of his love and commitment to you and commitment to us. Amen. Now, we have about 20-some-odd images of what Christ did on the cross in the New Testament. It was a sacrifice, redemption, propitiation, justification, sanctification. All the Asian words. We've got all of those, as we talked about. And we're going to go through all of those, and we're going to group these in different groups. And the biggest one that's used is sacrifice. Christ is a sacrifice. There are 32-some-odd passages that relate to just sacrifice. There's some extra ones about propitiation and a couple about atonement that we'll look at. But just using the sacrificial image. And sacrifice was very, very common in the ancient world. But it had a special group of a special set of significance for the Jewish people because their sacrificial system was different then. And we will look at that considerably over the next several weeks, how it was different from, quote-unquote, non-Jewish pagan sacrificial systems. These form a backdrop to the next syllabus that we'll have after we get through this one. This is, again, one of the most introductory. We are going to eventually get to the content. But this is an introductory one about sacrifice in the Old Testament. So if you look at the top, the work of Christ on the cross, sacrifice, I've got OT, the Tanakh Old Testament. Okay? And this is the backdrop, the stage that got set when Jesus Christ walked into history some 2,000 years ago. And when John the Baptist said, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world, all of the meaning, all of the freight, all the payload that we're going to be talking about that came from the Old Testament, in some cases even Greco-Roman religion, would have been just smuggled right into that phrase. And so anybody would have stood by and heard John the Baptist, who was the most famous religious leader in Israel's history at that point in time, when they called Jesus his cousin, second cousin, the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world, everybody wouldn't have said, what? They would have said, wow, the Lamb of God takes away the sins of the world. So there was some big freight that we have to take a look at as to what was behind that word. And what I've got here is a general introduction. I've got lots of textual stuff to read through. And I got to tell you, I got an email from somebody in the class this past week that said, we really appreciated that last session you had because it was more down to earth than you normally do, and I understood more of what you said, which was a nice way of saying that you confused me less than you normally do. I understood this. I can see these things. I have management savvy. I can read between the lines, right? And so they were going to be out of town, so I almost wrote the person back. It's a good thing you're going to be gone this Sunday then, because I'm not going to touch down at all. we're not going to even make any approaches to the ground at all. So you can, God providentially has moved you to Los Angeles for the week to protect you from the teacher here, right? So what we're going to do here is look at the introduction. The first thing that occurs after the garden, after the expulsion from the garden in Genesis 3, the very next passage, Genesis 4, has sacrifice in it. Boom. Instantly, somehow, religion offering sacrifices is there. Boom. These are people literally have firsthand knowledge of the Lord. It's right there. You know, the transition is very abrupt, but boom, you're right there. It's right there. Something's going on. And the first quote I'm going to read here is from a book on sacrifice. It says, "A sacrifice and offering are activities and concepts endemic to the human race. It's everywhere. The first act of worship outside the Garden of Eden was the presentation of offerings and sacrifices to Yahweh. Noah's first act of worship after the great flood subsided was the presentation of burnt offerings on the altar. Before his call, Abram was acquainted with sacrifice and offering. Soon after obeying the Lord's command, he built an altar at the Oak of Moreh, where the Lord had revealed himself. He built another altar between Bethel and Ai and called upon the name of Yahweh, and another at Hebron by the Oaks of Mamre. 3 months after the Israelites came out of Egypt, God called them together at Sinai. There he gave them the Torah, which included instructions for worshiping him, representing sacrifices and offerings. For God's new people, as well as for the ancestors of Israel and for primeval humankind, sacrifice and offering restored broken relationships between God and mankind and between men and women. The close relationship between this healing function of sacrifice and offering and the violent expulsion and separation of human beings from the Creator in Genesis 3 is emphasized by the writer of Genesis' close placement of Genesis 3 and Genesis 4. Radical rejection is pictured in 3:22 of Genesis. Remember, you got radically expelled from the garden. Okay, some kind of reconciliation and gesture of goodwill through the offering of sacrifice indicates a major function and meaning of sacrifice to the author of Genesis. Sacrifice and offering are as old as religion, and it appears that religion is as old as humankind. It's always been there. From the day one, we have always known that something is wrong, that something is wrong in our relationship with the universe, with God, with one another. There's something out of kilter. We normally try to fix these things ourselves with abysmal results, of course. And we're going to see it's how we took this basic thing that we had in Genesis 4 and as a community of people distorted it and trivialized it and brutalized it and things of this type. But fundamentally, it was a very important part. We don't use sacrificial terminology in the Western world much. If you think about, you know, terms in the first century when Paul would have gone and said, "Christ, our Passover, has been sacrificed for us," the Jews that he would have spoken to knew instantly what this was. If we went and said Christ was a ransom for us, the Romans would have known exactly what that meant. If we use the word like sacrifice in today's world, see, we put, I do know that about baseball, at least there's this thing called a sacrifice, right? And I do know as a part of upper management where you sacrifice somebody in middle management, as the sacrificial lamb for a given project. And there's always a scapegoat. There are images that we still have of being driven into the wilderness. Of course, is a golf term. Where you get close to God in the wilderness is Steve's reference, right? So we do have some terminology, but it doesn't communicate much. There's not a lot of freight to it. There's not a lot of import to that. And what I'm going to do here is, if you look at a pyramid, at the top is where Christ is, in the book of Hebrews, Christ is both the sacrifice, the atoning sacrifice, and the high priest at the same time. So he's both functions, right? And then the second layer is the Old Testament sacrificial system, which you have to understand what Christ sacrificed and the high priest was. And then there's a bottom of the pyramid that has all of sacrifice in the ancient world, which is going to show the difference between that and what God's sacrificial system in the Old Testament was. And so that's the way we're going to start from the bottom up. So really I am starting on the ground, so to speak, working up. Okay, so. And we're going to look at what sacrifice looked like outside of Israel back in those days. So I've got a number. We're just going to go a little, take a tour of the world. What was in ancient India, ancient China, ancient Mesoamerica? What did sacrifice look like? Was it even there? Was this just something weird that the Israelites did? And so I've got a series of boring quotes here that we're going to have to, I'm going to drag you through. You're the sacrificial things this time, right? And we're looking at the phenomena because, like I say, if we'd all started at the garden, okay, you're going to have some basic things that transfer all the way down humankind, right? If it all starts at the garden, it's going to go, and you're going to have, you only have like three generations between, overlapping generations between Adam and Noah. So, I mean, you've got, you know, granddads and great-granddads telling them what it was like in the garden in the first set of sacrifices. So when they decided to go do their own sacrifice, the great-granddad says, whoa, 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 no, no. We don't sacrifice the gerbil. The gerbil is not a clean animal. We don't do this, right? And so there would be a level of content continuity in those first generations. Then you have the great flood, and then it all starts over with Noah again, right? And then Noah has these sons, three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And the question is, how does the pure story stay with us? See, from Genesis. And it's interesting that the in Jewish tradition, by the way, the Melchizedek figure, remember Abraham, in Abraham's day, he went and paid tithes to Melchizedek, who was the king of Jerusalem. He was a Canaanite king, pagan king, and he blessed Abraham. The writer of Hebrews, remember, says the lesser is always blessed by the greater, right? Or the lessee, depending upon how the payment structure is set out. Okay? And in this kind of scenario, Abraham goes to Melchizedek, and Melchizedek, there's one Jewish current that says Melchizedek is Shem. See, because Shem has a very, very long lifespan after the flood, right? In the genealogies. And probably not, because, you know, didn't make, necessarily. But there's this tradition that somehow there's this body of tradition that was kept over there in Jerusalem by Melchizedek. So when Abraham, whose father was an idol worshiper in Mesopotamia, remember Terah, right? You know, and when Abraham gets over there, good chance he heard the gospel from Melchizedek. See, there's a good chance Melchizedek, who knew the Lord, you know, because there's a change in Abraham that occurs there in the text, and it's really strong. There's a good chance that some more information about what really, really was set up was imparted to Abraham through that encounter. Because he was blessed, he made a covenant with Melchizedek. And like I said, there's some ancient fuzzy tradition that says that it was really close to that primeval source of information about what sacrifice was like and what God was like and things of this type. So we're going to start first here on page one with some early cultures. Now, like I say, in the Western world, we live basically in denial of death. We don't think much in terms of death. It's for us, we don't think about it. It's taboo in our society. We remember people that have died in very innocent ways. In the ancient world, it was the opposite. You were scared to death of them. You were scared to death of them. And you were constantly offering sacrifices to dead ancestors. Your world was populated by spirits. It was overkill. The trees had spirits, you know, leeks and onions and garlics had spirits in them. You know, they act up on us night now. They give us dreams and visions. But back then, they had full divinities. They had full power of deity. And so there was literally a spirit under every bed and behind every face, you know, this kind of thing. And it is in this scenario that you can imagine that a lot of sacrifice came around. So in the first early cultures, if you look at the ones I've got mentioned here, India, for example, wholesale slaughter of animals has a similar motif in southern India. For example, the buffalo sacrifices at the Malayam devil dances and the Madiga festivals for the goddess Maharishi and other deities. Human sacrifice was practiced by the Khans of southern India and Vedic India. When the Vedas were written, practiced sacrifice of oxen. So the earliest cultures within India had not only regular animal sacrifices, but occasionally practiced human sacrifice. Okay? Occasionally practiced human sacrifice. China, the Shang Dynasty, which is one of the early powerful ones, 2000. Now, 2000 to 1500 is roughly Abraham to Moses kind of period. All right, so we're talking roughly there in captivity to Egypt, sort of, you know, roughly in that time frame, 2000 to 1500. The Shang's faith was shamanism. Now, shaman is the academic word for witch doctor. And the difference between a witch doctor and a priest, basically, a priest, religions that had priests, you had standards, so to speak. You had a standard ritual that you had to do for this kind of requirement. You had to do this following prescribed. But the shaman was an individualist. He could make up his own rules on the basis of his personal authority and his personal power. And so he was still a sort of priest, but he didn't have to follow anybody's rules. There wasn't a standard set of organizational lore or policy and procedure manual that the shaman had to do. He could just make it up as he was quite an entrepreneur. And the Shang's faith was shamanism. The Wu, who were seers, medicine men, and sorcerers, and their associates, the diviners, people who told fortunes or predicted the future, were the mediums between the spirit, supernatural world and the human world. They also served as scribes and clerks, ceremonial dancers, musicians, and even high-ranking officials. They were considerably overworked like today's pastors. Moreover, they were prototype intellectuals who not only could write and keep accounts, but who were also archivists and historians, because the cosmos of shamans is full of spirits of all kinds. The Shang state religion was mainly concerned with offering food and entertainment to male and female ancestors of the ruling house, okay, to deceased great men, and to the deities of the mountains, water, rivers, wind, and stars. Okay? The point was is that everything had a deity that had to be somehow entertained to keep them off your back. Okay, if they were happy and joking and chuckling, they didn't feel mischievous and go hit you with a plague or something. Right? Same thing about ancestors. You know, if you had not been nice to them when you were a kid, okay, they would get, or they weren't buried probably. We'll talk about burial practices here. They would get quite upset with you, and they could inflict a considerable damage on you, according to the shaman. In Africa, in all of Africa, the concept of feeding gods, feeding ancestors, charms, and all manner of beings or objects associated with supernatural powers is basic for any comprehension of the nature of sacrifices and the act of sacrificing. Because of the closeness of the supernatural to the everyday world, now by that it means, in other words, heaven for them or the supernatural realm was not up there, as we have in later like Zeus and the deities, the Greek gods, and things of this type. It was literally here. Trees had spirits. You were already walking in this world. Okay, it's the difference between a holy place and regular places. It was all commingled in this world. Because it was all around here, its beings were thought of and approached much in the manner in which human beings are thought of, okay, and acted toward. Therefore, just as human beings became weak and irritable, lose power and feel frustrated, thus perhaps becoming dangerous as they do not receive sustenance, so supernatural beings must be properly provided with the food they need if they are to function as aids to men and are not to turn on those to whom they look for provision of their needs. Now, the deities here are, they get hungry, and if they don't get fed, they get irritable. Okay, it's a fairly common trait, right? They get irritable. And if you give them the wrong food, they get irritable. If they're not satisfied, if they don't like the pasta you gave them, they get upset, right? And in this kind of scenario, you have a need relationship that's built between the human worshipers and these deities. You know, they're irritable. They're having a bad hair day up there. And, you know, they got to take care of them. And so there's this care and feeding mentality that develops. Care and feeding mentality. Middle America, Mesoamerican, Andean, sacrifices of human beings, animals, and goods were widely practiced in the area of the ancient Andean civilization. So that's the Andy Mountains range we're talking about. No ceremony, private or public, was performed without a bloody sacrifice and offerings. The Chibka kept children in the temples and killed them when they reached puberty. They grew them, okay, in the temple and sacrificed them when they reached puberty. Sacrifice was, a quote, sacrifice was the central moment of the cult. In Yucatec, it was called Pai Chi, opening of the mouth, from the practice of rubbing the mouth of the god statue with blood. Okay? Okay. Only seldom were the victims animals. Human sacrifices were preferred. During penitential rites, all people would bleed themselves. And in order to make the wounds more memorable, they would use the spine of a stingray. Okay? So this was to show the deity that you really meant it, as if they couldn't see your heart. Right? Right? Native North America, the presentation of valued or holy objects and materials to deities and spirits to induce or compel these to bestow their favors on the giver of such objects, is a common practice among North American Indians at this time frame. Individual men and women were constantly offering spirits to sacrifices to spirits, ghosts, deities, plants, and so forth. These consisted of bits of food thrown into the fire, pollen and down offerings, beads, pinches of tobacco, among other things. A man or woman digging plants to be used as medicine in the eastern United States always left tobacco at the spot in payment. If not, the cure wouldn't work. Because if you didn't offer a little, you know, a couple of cigarettes right there where you took the rutabaga out, the rutabaga wasn't going to heal. You had to do a little transaction like that. Low tar wasn't acceptable. It had to be real cigarettes in this case, right? Groups sacrificed together. Probably the two best known such groups sacrifices were the Seneca Iroquois white dog ceremony. This was a bloodless sacrifice where they strangled the dog because blood was forbidden for them to use, so they strangled the dog. And the Morning Star ceremony in which a female captive of another tribe was sacrificed, the skin upon it. Also notice self-torture in Plains Indian Sundance. They would do the same thing. They would offer the joints of one's fingers as a sacrifice, and ritual cannibalism of war prisoners. Okay, as religious rites. You know, this wasn't just, you know, vengeance. This was a religious rite. Okay? The ancient Greeks, sacrifice to the Olympian gods was indeed a smoke offering. The gods, for their part, needed the meat savor. They grew desperate without it. Not just irritable, but desperate. They had to have this smoke. Blood sacrifices were used to ward off attacking spirits. It was a voluntary human scapegoat, drowning or stoning for the city. What that is if the city were under some kind of plague or some kind of major attack, and the city council decided that they were guilty as a city, they would pick somebody to be a scapegoat, literally, in the same kind of way we have in an Old Testament picture. They would take somebody that was generally voluntarily, but it could either be somebody from the lower classes or a politically inspired movement within a family to act somebody, and that person would take on the plague of the, you know, whatever the city was, the sin that the city was doing, and they would be drowned or stoned to death to appease whatever deity was inflicting the plague. Okay, and the substitution, sometimes the substitution motifs where you're taking the place of in the sacrifice are almost comical. In Mesopotamia, for example, if somebody was on the sickbed, in some cases they would take a goat and dress them up in that person's clothes and lay them next to that person. Then maybe the spirit would, you know, they don't have corrective lenses in the spirit world. Perhaps they would get a little confused and move the disease over to the little goat that was dressed up like Glenn, you know, whatever, always wearing the blue and the gray, you know, dressed up like Glenn. And perhaps they would try to use that kind of thing to ward it away or to attract it or something this type. Because the notion of that the deities were, the spirits were focused on them. Now, that's the wider area. Okay, now let's zone in a little bit closer to Israel. Now we're going to look at Mesopotamia and Egypt and Syria, Palestine. Yes. Well, they're the earliest statements. When the Mesoamericans are not, I mean, they're much later. You know, which when we get to the Andean religions, Aztecs and the Mayans and stuff, they're much later than Israel and Mesopotamia. So most of these are the ones in India, China, roughly are, And the ones we're about to look at are contemporaneous with old Israel. But the New World, our cultures in the New World were much, much later, basically. It was, from what we know, it was there wasn't any sacrificial value in them cutting themselves per se. In other words, the blood was always representative of death, as it is in the Old Testament. The life was in the blood. This was more like to work yourself up in a frenzy like the prophets of Baal. So they would cut themselves. They would put markings. We don't know fully what those were intended to do other than to show very serious, you know, like fasting, you know, show that you were really seriously committed to this. That's all we know. We don't know, have a lot of explanation about that other than the human sacrifices that they did. We don't have a lot of data on that. Good question. Good question. Now, we zone in closer to those people that had direct influence on Israel. So Mesopotamia is, you know, the Tigris-Euphrates River. Remember, Abraham comes out of Sumer, comes out of Mesopotamia, and they're going to spend 430-odd years in Egypt. So Egypt has gotten, then they're going to go up into the land of Palestine, into Canaan, and they're going to be Canaanites up there. So those are the next three sets of sacrifices that we're going to sort of look at. Mesopotamia. The main concern in Mesopotamian sacrificial practice was undoubtedly the care and especially the feeding of divine images. Not the gods themselves, but the images, the statues. Okay? This view of sacrifice was fundamentally influenced by the idea that deities were represented by man-made images, and led to a much greater concern with the image's own mundane needs than with the person and requirements of the deity. Okay? In other words, they had a statue of a god, and the statue of the god had to be clean. That got higher priority than the person of the deity itself that was represented by the image, is what we're saying. In other words, first things first, you've got to keep the image clean. Right? You've got to wash it, feed it, things of this type. As a result, sacrifice in Mesopotamia was a rather more down-to-earth affair in comparison with the concepts of sacrifice repeatedly advocated by the Old Testament writers. In the Old Testament writers, you are mostly focused on the heart of God. See, he's not even going to let you do an image. If you do an image, you've got to do a sacrifice to cover the image. Because the image is a problem. He doesn't want all this wasted stuff. He's trying to get a heart-to-heart relationship. That's what he's always gone for, and we'll always go for that. Right? No substitutes allowed. Okay? But they were just focused on the images. Another very important aspect of the feeding of gods was the food and drink offerings, regularly provided for the spirits of the dead. Much Mesopotamian religion was animistic in character, which means that everything had an animus, which is the word for spirit. Like I say, the rutabaga had a spirit, the onion had a spirit, the gerbil and the hamster had a spirit. Everything had a spirit. Mountains, trees, animistic in character, and particularly as far as ordinary people were concerned, religion was probably more about placating and pacifying the spirits and demons rather than the major gods who had their temples and images of their own. Okay, so I'm an ordinary peasant in Mesopotamia, okay, and I'm not really worried about the big deities because they've got their own temples, they've got their own dedicated staff, full-time staff there, feeding them, taking care of them. I'm worried about my ancestors. I'm worried about the people that I shafted that died last year that are going to come back and haunt me. I'm worried about, my rutabaga patch, the spirits of those. I'm more worried about the little small ones, because those seem to be the ones that get me after me all the time, as opposed to the big ones that the people get paid to keep happy. Okay, the official temples and priesthood. So the ordinary citizen was more dealing with these small fry that just sort of nipped and tucked at you. When a person died, it was believed that his spirit entered the underworld, the place where dust is their food and clay their sustenance. It was therefore necessary to provide the spirits of the deceased with a more satisfying diet. He likes to eat mud all the time, right? If this responsibility was neglected, the spirits might return to earth hungry and thirsty. In other words, you're always living in fear here. You're always in fear. And when we get to the New Testament, we'll have that wonderful passage over in Hebrews where the power of the devil had to do with those that were always under fear of death. There's a fear of death that we get released from with the free gift of eternal life, and this thing all changes. And so in this kind of scenario, they were always worried about all these little bitty deities and ancestors, and you had to always keep caring for these people and all this kinds of stuff. And now we have a couple of quotes here, actually, from literature of the day. All right, so now we're talking about stories in, like, the Babylonian and the Mesopotamian creation stories. So they've got documents that we dig up, you know, it's got all this ancient writing on it. And here's the first one about why the deities created humans, okay? When Marduk hears the words of the gods, his heart, Marduk is one of the big deities there, his heart prompts him to fashion artful works. Opening his mouth, he addresses Ea to impart the plan he had conceived in his heart. Blood I will mass and cause bones to be. I will establish a savage. Man shall be his name. Verily, savage man I will create. He will be charged with the service of the gods that they might be at ease. So now, this is the religion that you grew up with. Your whole existence was so that they could take a day off up there, right? And you just had to work your fingers to the bone to keep these people, you know, the deities pacified. If that's what you grew up, the possibility of a delightful relationship with these deities probably wouldn't enter your mind much. See? Your job was to keep them fed, clothed, etc. Nails clipped, the whole nine yards, right? That they might be at ease, okay? And just to show you how dependent this deity was, though, now we have the next quote is from the Babylonian Noah. We have flood traditions in every major culture of the world, and they are very, very similar, as you would expect if it all came down from Noah, if everybody descended. You'd imagine that the story stayed somewhat clean. You have, but in one of the early ones, one we've got here from the Epic of Gilgamesh, their version of Noah describes what happens when he gets off the ark. Okay, when he gets off the ark, this is the way he describes the original sacrifice. Now, what did Noah do, by the way? When Noah got off the ark, what was the first thing Noah did? He offered some sacrifices. He took up the clean birds and offered some sacrifices. The first thing he did, and then the next thing he did was he got drunk. Yeah, that's a separate problem. As fast as he could get those vines to grow. But in this epic of Gilgamesh, this one says, "Then I let all out to the four winds, and I offered a sacrifice. I poured out a libation on top of the mountain. Seven cult vessels I set up. Upon their pot stands I heaped cane, cedar wood, and myrtle to burn it. The gods smelled the savor. The gods smelled the sweet savor. The gods crowded like flies around the sacrifice." Remember, they hadn't gotten any of that sweet savor stuff. They were starving to death. They crowded like flies around. They fought for elbow room at the table. This is what we would call a low view of deity, a low view of God. Okay, crowded like flies around the table. Now, elsewhere you have people that are a little bit more cynical about this. A little bit more cynical. And so you have an instruction, a dialogue of pessimism, which is an ancient piece of literature between a servant and his master. And the servant obviously has three times the IQ of the master, because this is the way he will take every kind of comment and he will work real well. And so you'll see the dialogue, and the way the structure goes is the master gives an instruction to the servant. The servant says, "Great idea, boss, because if you do this, this will happen." And then the servant changes his mind and says, "Well, no, I've changed my mind. I don't want to do that." And the servant says, "Great idea again, boss. Here's a good reason not to do it." And so at the last one in the dialogue of pessimism, you have this. "Servant, obey me." "Yes, my lord, yes." "Bring me at once water from my hands and give it to me. I will offer a sacrifice to my God." "Offer, my lord, offer. A man offering sacrifice to his God is happy. Loan upon loan he makes." Okay, loan upon loan he makes. The guy changes his mind and says, "No, servant, a sacrifice to my God I will not offer." "Oh, do not offer it, my lord, do not offer it. You may teach a god to trot after you like a dog when he requires of you celebrate my ritual." So you can manipulate this deity by either offering the sacrifice or not. You either make loans, and so you can go claim it. You've got a credit balance with God. You need a little favor, need a little political kick here. Go in there and say, "Hey, you owe me one, God. You've got to help me out here." Now, this is surprisingly modern. We'll pause here for just a moment to do self-inflicted. This is where we use the stingrays. This might have a stingray ourselves, or our conscience here. But this is very surprisingly modern. And the other one, of course, is that, I'll hold it. I'll withhold my being good from God and punish him and treat him to chase me like a dog. See, again, this is not the most high view of deity, right? But it was very practical. I mean, it's very practical because this is the way they didn't know what they were dealing with. One of the most sobering prayers I have ever read is a Mesopotamian prayer where you have a worshiper that's under some kind of, duress, some kind of bad situation. You get up there, and he has no idea what they've done wrong and has no idea what deity they have offended. And they go through a list of, they go down all the list of the known deities. It's like 50. If I have offended you with this, I'm sorry. If I offended you with this, I'm sorry. If I've offended you with this, I'm sorry. Goes through this list, and then he says, and whoever I've overlooked in terms of deity or sin, I'm sorry, I don't know. There's a hopelessness about that that's just staggering. I was thinking this morning, I'm praying before the Lord. I get access to my God. There are no dead gerbils. There are no smoking Cheerios in the toaster oven. I walked freely. It took a sacrifice to get me there, but it wasn't mine. It wasn't mine. And I get this free access into the grace of where we stand, Romans 5, on the basis of something God did instead of me. I did instead of me. There's a question, is atheism a relatively late thing? Professional atheism sort of is. Philosophical is. Practical atheism has been around since day one. You have the old God's not paying attention, basically. It was what they have is a different kind of deity. They still believe in a deity. There's a question whether there is such a thing, to be quite frank, as a real atheist. I mean, that's a separate, altogether different argument as to whether everybody knows in their heart there's a God there. I'm convinced they do, but you can sit there and you can suppress the truth. We know there's lots of things we do, as a matter of course, that you could do for longer periods of time and come out in that position. So, but from a theoretical standpoint, there weren't. You would spoof the gods around 200 A.D. So once you get into late Greco-Roman, the Greek and Roman writers, the intellectuals of the day, they would start saying, I'm not so sure about some of these deities, especially those ones we voted into office last week. Because you would do that, you could vote, you could become a god by the Senate. The Roman Senate could vote you to that lower, you were a third-rate deity, but you were still a deity. You still got homage, you still got sacrifices and things of that type. So the Greeks would sit there and say, I'm not sure about this, and the Romans would say, I'm not sure, but they started discounting sacrifice, by the way, about 200 A.D. They'd start writing and asking these questions about that as well. Right. Yeah, and he said, you're superstitious. They agreed. They didn't have a problem. You're right. They didn't have a problem. They quibbled over the resurrection because of their view of the soul. Right. So you don't have this much. Like I say, we live in Western culture in denial of so much stuff. And sometimes I wonder, why is it we don't offer sacrifice? Well, we try the bargaining with God, the loan upon loan. God, if you get me out of this one, I'll quit this. I'll give up this. I'll be this. We try the bargaining thing, just like they did in Mesopotamia. Right? But it doesn't get the same level of severity. We don't really track real heavily with this. We're not aware of impending doom unless we built a guilt complex up for other reasons. But they lived in this in a regular basis back there. They were closer to it. Some of it is just sort of, paranoia. You don't know much about the world. You don't know what's going to hit you. It doesn't help a lot when you know a lot about the world because you still got providence. I mean, so it doesn't make a huge difference there. But they were very, very superstitious. We're going to see a very superstitious people next, according to the ancients. Because they would judge each other's culture on the basis of how religious or how superstitious or how noble they were. The Greeks looked up to the Jews, for example, that they had one God and they had a good law. Remember, God said that my law, if you follow my law, I'll distinguish you among all the nations and it'll be your glory. And when they did it, when they got even close, let's put it this way, people looked up to them. The Greeks, in the Greek literature, they admire the Jews early on. They admire the Jewish people for the purity of their religious tenets. So, and the last comment there is Mesopotamian sacrifices never burned and never eaten by the community of lay worshipers. Now, see, what we're going to do, we're going to come back and compare and contrast these with the law that God gave sacrificial system that God gave into Moses, because it's going to be day and night different. You're going to be really surprised at this. But one of the differences is that Mesopotamian sacrifice was never burned, which means somebody ate it. Guess who ate it? The priest. It wasn't the lay people. Lay people will always just bring in the sheep, drop them off. That was their sacrifice. Lay people, right? Yeah, right. Something like that, right? Well said. Well said. And what would happen is that the priest would take what was ever in there, and they would close the doors, and they did the private sacrifice. It was all a private thing. They got no benefits out of this thing. Okay. And in this scenario, you have it was never burned. What they would do. Remember, I think we went through this before. But they would come out in the morning and they would change the clothes of the statue. Remember? They would change the clothes, they'd wash them up, scrub it down, those little spongy things. And then they would dress them up again, they'd put the food out on the table, and they'd wait until they had eaten their share. Right? Because they ate the insubstantial part. In other words, the aura of the food is what the god ate, and the rest of the more mundane stuff was for the priest to eat. Remember, this is the best of breed stuff. You only bought the best stuff to the priest, and then they ate what was left. And making a facade out of this slightly, but I mean, it was very serious business to these folk. I mean, it really was serious, and in some cases, we have elements of a true pietistic feeling, of real feeling. It's extreme minority, but there are still those moments that you find in the literature of sincerity about this and a humility that you don't normally find in normal where you're trying to manipulate the god and get him to trot after you by a dog. Now, in Egypt was a little different. Egypt, of course, they kept all of their deities, the statues, behind closed doors, and the lay people never saw the deities except when they had something like Mardi Gras. And they'd put them up on the little parade thing, and then they'd do the deities through the city. And so they'd get to see the deities once or twice a year, and then they'd go behind closed doors. And among the priests, only the head priests got to really see the deity because they were in the inner sanctum of this thing. And these were gods that just had wanted nothing to do with the people. This was the point, you know. Nothing to do with these folk, you know, but we were just trying to keep them off our back. That was what religion was about. And so after the offerings had been placed, so here's the description about the deities in there, and they close the door, nobody's coming in, they put the food on the table. After the offerings had been placed on the altars and purified, the highest ranking priest opened the doors of the sanctuary at the exact moment in which the sun appeared on the horizon. Remember, they worshiped the sun in there. Accompanied by hymns that were intended to propitiate, which means pacify at some level or satisfy, the awakening of the god who lived within the temple. This marked the beginning of the most important and solemn phase of the worship. The priest entered the darkness of the sanctuary, barely lit by torches, and opened the door of the shrine containing the statue of the god, lock upon lock upon lock. The deity then revealed himself, meaning the image, to the eyes of his officiant, privileged by his sight of the statue of the idol in which the god allowed himself to be seen. See, this was the holiest of moments. The laying of hands on the statue and the recital of prayers preceded the sacred meal. This was composed of the offerings that had been placed on the altars, the actual possession of which was turned, as the Egyptian said, to the priest and other temple personnel who used the food for their daily meals. Again, they ate the food. The god received only that part which evaded the perception of the senses. So the rutabaga had this little ghost thing around it, and that was what you couldn't see, which is what the god ate. The rest, composed of a denser physical reality, was for human consumption. The next phase involved tending to the actual person of the god, that is, his statue, which was treated as though it were a human being. It was washed, made up, they put mascara on these deities, okay, dressed in new clothes, which replaced those it had worn the previous day. They didn't wash this, these were new things. It should be noted that each of these acts was surrounded by precise ritual prescriptions, such as the offering of 4 strips of the finest quality linen in 4 different colors, white, blue, green, and red. In certain circumstances, the god was adorned with jewels and other symbolic objects connected to his typology. Finally, the priest who had opened the shrine and performed the entire ritual anointed the statue with oil and made an offering of grains and rice and resin. This was the end of the ceremony. All that remained was to close the door of the shrine once more and to reattach the seal, which would be broken the following day. While some final acts, such as the libation of water and burning of incense, were performed, darkness once again enveloped the shrine in which the statue of the god was kept. He only came out for a few minutes every day, only to one or two people, and that was his whole job. That was his whole job. Egyptian sacrifice was never burned and never eaten by the community of regular people. Again, it was all in for the priest. Now, people respected Egyptian religion for the longest time. They thought that was clever. I mean, it was ritual, like they do today. If you have a really clean religion and it's all neat and orderly and tidy and God is trotting after you like a dog, people will respect that. Okay, people respect that kind of order and obsessive compulsive behavior, at least in Western culture. Right? And it was the same way there. But then eventually some people looked at that and said, that is just silly. And what we have are two quotes from the ancient world. Herodotus, one of the earliest historians in the 5th B.C., is praising the Egyptians, describing their things. And then you've got Lucian, who is a satirist in the Roman Empire, is just going to rip their face off with satire as to how silly these people are. So Herodotus describes some of the priestly rituals. The priests shave their bodies all over every other day, okay, to guard against the presence of lice or anything else equally unpleasant, while they are about their religious duties. Also, the priests wear linen only and shoes made from the papyrus plant, these materials for dress and shoes being the only ones allowed them. They bathe in cold water twice a day. Don't know whether that was cool in hot Egypt or not, but that was twice a day and twice every night, and observe innumerable other ceremonies besides. Their life, however, is not by any means all hardship, but they enjoy advantages too. For instance, they are free from all personal expense. They were 501 corporations, basically. Having bread made for them out of the sacred grain, and a plentiful daily supply of goose meat and beef, with wine in addition. Fish they are forbidden to touch, and as for beans, they cannot even bear to look at them because they imagine they are unclean. They do not have a single priest for every god, but a number, of which one is chief priest, and when a chief priest dies, his son is appointed to succeed him. See, this is a complex thing. We normally take something that's just a human thing. We take something that's very simple and make it very, very complex. Okay? If it's a very simple thing, what has the Lord required of you but to love mercy, to do justice, walk humbly with your God, and we turn it into you have to bathe four times a day in cold water. Shave your hair, you know, all over, and all these little things, right? Gives us this illusion of control. And then Juvenal, in his satire, he's describing again the Egyptians. All the world, he's writing to the Lucius, knows what monsters are objects of reverence to the superstitious insanity of Egypt. One district adores the crocodile, another stands in awe of the snake gorging ibis, the long tailed ape, too, is a sacred being. Its golden image glitters in the spot where the mutilated Memnon's wizard chords make music, and where lies an ancient ruin, Thebes, with all her 100 gates. In one part, whole towns worship the cat, and another the fish of the river, and yet another the hound, albeit Diana the huntress has not a single worshiper. But to profane leek or onion with a crunching tooth is an abomination. Devout indeed must be a people that has such deities sprouting in its kitchen gardens. Right? So you see the little biting satire there about biting your deity. You've got to be careful. I guess you can just let it melt in your mouth, but you don't want to crunch it with a tooth. So indeed must be this. And so this is where Egypt, 400 years, Israel spent in that environment. And then they went into Syria-Palestine, where it gets really bad. In Syria-Palestine, most of the prohibitions against bogus worship and abusive worship in the Old Testament are against this next group in Syria and Palestine, the Canaanites, the Philistines. And their religious practices were much more intense, shall we say, but much more abusive, much more abusive. This is Ugarit, 14th, 13th century B.C. They had child sacrifice. They had cult prostitution, self-mutilation. All of the worst that we have seen so far was there in that land. Okay? Worship of the dead. It was a particularly bad scene. They had, I won't go into some of the other kind of things that they did. But they had burnt offerings, which included children. Okay? you know, you made a burnt offering, and none of the other cultures we've talked about so far had burnt offerings. And we'll talk about what a burnt offering was in Israel probably next week. But in this kind of scenario, they had burnt offerings, and they had community worship. In other words, when they would have a sacrifice, they would have a communal meal. Remember how none of these others, it was only the priests that ate it? And guess what situation was the very first communal meal that we have in the Old Testament? You know, after Moses. We have that thing of Peor, Balaam and Balak, right? Where it was a sexually promiscuous thing. It was a bacchanalian orgy. That's what these were. That's what their ceremonies were basically orgies. We had a similar one, of course. Remember when Moses brought them out, they did the thing about the golden calf. That's what it was. They sat down to eat, and they rose up to play, is what it says. Okay, and that was, again, a Canaanite kind of thing. And so this was the situation where God says, don't do this. This is why I'm kicking them out of the land. Okay, don't be like these people. Don't blend in with the crowd here. You don't want to do this, or guess what? I'll have to kick you out too. Right? Human sacrifice, real strong stuff. And the summary points here before we close is that sacrifice has been everywhere, every era, and every conceivable object. You could sacrifice it or sacrifice to it, just about. Okay? This is magic versus religion. This is where you're controlling your fortune, you're controlling your deity, trotting after you like a dog, taking advantage of the dependencies. This has got their considerable magic issues over against a personal religion. It was largely avoidance of misfortune versus celebration of benevolence. You did not have celebration sacrifices like we will see as the dominant sacrifice in Israel. They didn't get together and party because God was good to them at all. Okay? They partied for other reasons, but it had nothing to do with God. Okay? But they were trying to avoid some kind of misfortune that was about to hit them, or had already hit them, or what they figured was about to hit them, because some diviner had told them, you're about to get here, so you better pay your dues. Clean up your life, kind of thing. Okay? And so it was a magic versus avoid religion. So often abused. When you start growing children in the temple, the sacrifice of the deity, something's out of whack. Something's out of whack. You have missed something. See? When he said, my burden is light, my yoke is easy. If it ain't easy and yoke, it ain't his. If it ain't easy and light, it ain't his. You done made your own up. You done added some extra stuff to this thing. Because his is easy and light. But there's a fundamental admission of a problem. The gap between God and humans needs work. There's something that we know is out of whack. And depending upon our culture, our background, we try to patch it up, or else we live in complete denial of it. I don't need God because my income is in this bracket. I don't need God because I've got the following five friends. I don't need God because, you know, we will come up with whatever the juicy rationalization of the decade for us is to avoid recognizing that there is a problem here, and it is a serious problem. And we're going to see that, as I mentioned, the thing about me walking into that presence this morning. That problem was resolved marvelously. Marvelously, without me having to lift a finger for that sucker. All I had to do was say, that one's mine. I claim that one. That's all I had to do in that. You have a couple of things. In other words, all it takes, it's like today. I saw a special one time, some stand-up comedian was saying, he was going to win the lottery by contacting the previous 25 lottery winners and finding out what their secrets were to winning a lottery. And so what would happen if somebody comes up and makes a prediction that it's going to happen this way, or they offer the following chant? I got three volumes of chants of how you ward off things from, like, warts to, you know, barking dogs, how you keep them at bay, because the chant worked twice, right? I got a sample size of two. I'm going to extrapolate and say, bingo, that works for me, right? And so you get into this little habit pattern, it's a little, you know, rabbit's foot. And so you have enough accidental successes over a wide population base, and you sit there and say, click, it's there. Now, you still have demonic influences. You do have oracles. You know, you do have that dimension that's there. So you do have ecstatic divination. This is part of why God says, don't go to those folk, because you open yourself up to a spiritual reality that you can't control. That you can't control your own self, much less another spirit that's a little more significant than you. That's why you don't go screw around with mystics and mediums and stuff like that. Because when you say, I'm dependent upon you, I'm opening myself up to this dimension that you have zero control over. Because it operates in a range you have. You can't control yourself, much less something of that magnitude and power. And subtlety is a better way of saying it. That level of subtlety, you can't even see its effects. That was what was the real problem, for one of the big problems for Israel. Not just the behavior of sacrificing children, but it got them off the track, as it indeed did. Good question. Okay, so we will come next week, and we'll actually get into the Mosaic Covenant. We'll actually see where God said, don't be like these. It's simpler, folk. It's a very basic lesson we're trying to do. So let's close in a word of prayer. God, we just thank you that we can approach you freely. Gosh, that you just stepped into history. You did all this, the priest and the sacrifice. One lick. Boom. And we can just charge right in. Freely. Forgiveness of sins, acceptance, affirmation. You've delighted in us, you actually say. And we just cannot thank you enough for what your son did. We just pray that we would understand that and relax in the light of that. And approach you without trying to make bargains and loans and trying to play these games with you, God, please. Help us approach you as a person instead of a system to work. We ask this for your son's sake.